Finance Committee on the 14th of April.
Okay. It is contentious. Thank you, gentlemen. Is there any discussion on the on this matter? Anybody want to move them? Nobody wants to move them. Let's go to the Dash 3 amendments. Somebody tell me what these are. This is actually the, this is the ones that became the Dash 4, aren't they?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's really it. What about Dash 1 amendments? Do we need to make that?
Adopted Dash 1.
We already did that.
Those were adopted.
Okay, so what we have is we have House Bill 2190 as amended, which are amended by the Dash 4 amendments.
Didn't we remove the Dash 1 amendments?
We already.
I think we already amended that, didn't we? We already amended the Dash 1 amendments in. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the chair entertained a motion to take House Bill 2190 as amended to the full committee. Representative Phillips moves House Bill 2190 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any further, any discussion on that motion?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Rear.
Just briefly, I'm going to vote in favor of the motion, but as one who sat through those meetings convened by Representative Hooley, who was then chair of the Subcommittee of Ways and Means, which had responsibility for developing. Recall that Mr. O'Leary represented the DA's Association, and I thought his contribution was a very positive one in terms of his willingness to compromise. I realized that he was not in the position necessarily, of course, of being able to speak on behalf of all 36 independently elected district attorneys. So I guess I'm personally not surprised that there may be a difference of opinion from the different district attorneys' offices. And certainly we've heard some further expression of that consideration of this bill. One thing, however, was clear, and that's that if we change the laws as it relates to recoupment for cases which have been compromised or diverted, we are probably going to be buying ourselves in the state of Oregon a lawsuit in federal district court. Going to be substantial cost to the state in terms of defending this change in the law, which may not be defensible, may be difficult to uphold. So I guess I just state that for purpose of the record. And so we know what we're doing if we choose to forward this to full committee and pass it.
We have a question, Representative Springer. Do we still have the same degree of a problem with the Dash 1 amendments that were adopted to read when the court orders dismissal pursuant to this section, the court may also order that defendant pay costs and expenses? You're suggesting that the challenge will arise if the court uses its discretion to order payment of costs and expenses? That answers my question. Thank you.
That answers your question. I'd also, before I put the vote on this, just add the caveat to the committee that we may have, council pointed out in the Dash 4 amendments on page 2, the question, I believe, about the constitutionality, or at least the constitutionality of directing in a civil case those funds to go into the general fund. So we may have to make a correction to that portion of it.
All right, we're going to remind you. I thought the governor was going to explore that. Maybe we can come back to full committee when we get there.
Well, I'm wondering, yeah, if we consider that to be a conceptual motion that way, and then if we can make that change in full committee without having to bring it back to sub.
That only relates to really the last.
Just the last.
Two lines of that, starting at 7, going through 11 on that. That's sub B.
That's correct.
Yeah.
So as long as everyone understands that, that concept is there, then I think we can go ahead and move on this. Yes.
Also, inconsistencies between the two sets.
Yeah.
And point it out to the full committee.
Okay. We'll work out any inconsistencies that exist. I just, for the record, I'd like to say I'll save my comments. Clerk, call the roll.
No.
Aye.
Phillips?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Take a 5-minute break. Just five, two folks. Committee back to order. We have, I'm going to go on House Bill 3048, and then we'll go to after that, we'll go to 2869. On 3048, rather, Senator Wires, if you want to call, you have some, there are some amendments, I believe. Dash five amendments. Point, just if you would explain.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you also have in your file a memo from Cynthia Carter, Assistant Attorney General, commenting on these and saying that she's reviewed them.
Today's file.
There's was a question about whether this amended the relating clause. This adds to the relating clause, creating new provisions and amending and enlisting the ORSs that are amended and the one that's repealed. So it's not a broadening of it to cover additional subjects, which I think is the restriction on changing, on adding to or changing emergency clauses. And otherwise, this is the bill that adds the suspension of driver's registration for a period of time post-conviction on prostitution.
Okay, so the dash five amendments are the, we have not adopted any other amendments to this, so the dash five amendments would effectively be the bill.
That's correct.
Okay. Okay, and everybody's seen the AG's letter on that. Are there any questions, Senator Wires? Chair entertain a motion on the amendments, which are the dash five amendments. Representative Springer?
So moved.
Representative Springer moves to amend House Bill 3048 with the dash five amendments with their LC 2353. Is there any discussion on those amendments? Is there any objections to the amendments? If not, that is so ordered. And chair entertain a motion on the main bill.
Move to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Springer moves House Bill 3048 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on that? If not, quick call roll.
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Burton?
Aye. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, let's go to 2869. We have a massive set of amendments there. I think Mr. Lezak probably finally slipped away. I don't know if he wants to come up. Mr. Reeves, I know that you're here. Who's going to explain this to us? We have the, who actually did the dash five amendments? These are at the
direction of the committee, I guess. Kingsley would be the next one.
I have a.
Bill, do you want to join him? Slezak, anybody?
Yeah.
I don't know if we're going to have
a reason. I had better be up here. I'd like to.
That's where I get
the company. Oh, good.
Yeah.
Why don't you go ahead and just make copies of it? We have a sort of a brief that we're having copied that'll We have these dash three amendments, which are larger than life, and that's at the direction of this committee. Would you like to comment on anything in particular or general?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Bill Linden, State Court Administrator. I have dash four amendments and a commentary explaining what those amendments do.
Well, I have
copies of those.
Let's see. I'm sorry. I'm operating off the wrong pile of stuff. We've got the dash four amendments. We set the dash three amendments aside. Is that correct?
Correct.
Thank you. Set the dash three amendments aside. We're working off dash four amendments. My apologies there.
Mr. Chairman, I can run through the sections and tell you very briefly what they...
I'd appreciate that.
Okay. Section one merely abolishes the State Indigent Defense Board. Sections two through seven transfer the board functions to the State Court Administrator under the supervision of the Chief Justice. Section 8 is a provision that provides, wherever it's necessary in statute, the State Court Administrator is substituted for State Indigent Defense Board Administrator. Section 9 creates a separate Indigent Defense operating account and sets up what has been referred to as the firewall between the Indigent Defense Appropriation and the Judicial Department appropriation, which makes it clear that one is not to be used to subsidize the other. It's a two-way firewall.
This is under Section 5?
Section 9.
9, I'm sorry.
Section 14 of the bill provides that judges certify amounts submitted to by the court for payment. Certify that these amounts are proper and reasonable. This relates to requests for attorney fee payments. It, however, takes out the existing requirement that the judge order the payment be made, and in their so doing reduces potential conflict if it's later determined that the payment was not proper or that there's a lack of information. The dilemma we get into right now is we have situations where a judge orders payment. We later find that the proper documentation wasn't filed with the case, or that there was an arithmetic error or something of that nature. We have to pay judges' orders as they come into us, and this would merely require the judges still review each and every attorney fee billing, certify that it's reasonable, sign off on it, but then there wouldn't be an accompanying order. We would merely pay on based on the certification, so that if we found that documentation was lacking or that there was an arithmetic error, we don't have to send it back to the court for further review, a subsequent order, etc. There's also a change in Section 14 that requires counsel to submit more detailed information for the authorization of expenditures for expenses. In other words, it would require more detail background on investigators, expert witnesses, psychiatric exams, and those kind of expenses. It would also allow, Section 14 would also allow the State Court Administrator to require that any certification by the court for payment out of the Indigent Defense account be accompanied by other information identified or requested as needed for audit or statistical purposes. The next major section, Section 22, has to do with appointments in juvenile cases, and it amends Chapter 419 so that in delinquency cases, a child is entitled to court-appointed counsel only if the child would be entitled to counsel if the child were an adult charged with the same offense. This suggestion came to us from several judges who are concerned under existing law they have to appoint counsel for juveniles who are charged with, for example, minor in possession cases. And this would make those juveniles eligible for counsel only if they'd be eligible as an adult. Section 27 repeals the Indigent Defense Board and the Office of the Indigent Defense Administrator and the arbitration provisions that the Indigent Defense Board has been operating under. Section 28 adds an emergency clause to the bill, and I'd like to emphasize that point. If there's going to be a shift of the functions from the board to the Judicial Department, it needs to be done as quickly as possible. We have contracts expiring June 30th of this year, and that's not very far off.
Okay, I think everybody's been given kind of a breakdown analysis there that came from the Judicial Department, which is just what Mr. Linder went through.
Yes.
this discussion just a little bit.
Okay. Yeah, I think your reference down here in Section 22, House Bill 2747, I think we just passed that out of committee the other day, so. That's consistent. You're saying that's consistent with this language. Well, what we have here, in fact, then, is in effect a bill which sets up, abolishes the Indigent Defense Board and the Office of State Indigent Defense Administrator. And then in the Section 9, establishes what we're referring to here as a firewall or an impermeable membrane or something to that effect. Let's go through and see if there's questions on, first of all, discussion on abolishment of the State Indigent Defense Board. Anyone have any comments or statements to be made there? I'm Representative Springer.
Well, I guess this is a question before I get to an expression of my feelings on that particular point. Are these amendments or these sections divisible in the sense that we could choose to separate those amendments which abolish the board from those sections which make other changes that are independent of the question of the future of the board?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Springer, I think some of them are separable. In other words, you could retain the Indigent Defense Board and you could still create a firewall. You could retain the board and you could change the current law that requires judges to order payments be made and just, you know, incorporate the change here that they certify that the amounts are reasonable. So I think you could pick and choose. Some of them are separable.
Thank you. I guess if you're asking for my expression on the Indigent Defense Board, though I don't necessarily claim direct responsibility as inherent of the concept, it was something that was worked on during the 83 biennium and the 85 session when I believed received, if not overwhelming, certainly large majorities on both sides. And I think for reasons that have been explained, I think more clearly in this committee and in the Ways and Means Committee, the problem is funding, not the concept of the Indigent Defense Board itself. I'm, at this point, opposed to eliminating the board because I've not been satisfied that the reasons and the, I guess, the rationality that guided us to adopt the board have been proven to me to be incorrect. And in fact, I think if we were to abolish the board, we're going to just recreate problems which existed for the Chief Justice before the board was created, and I don't think those problems are going to disappear, and in fact, they may intensify if we eliminate the board.
Okay.
The rest of the bill I'm prepared to support, but doing away with the board, I'm not.
All right. Anyone else want to comment on that aspect of the bill? No. How about the, of course, Section 8, basically, and all those changes relate to the previous section. What about the two-way firewall? Would you explain that a little bit more? How would that work? That just,
Mr. Chairman, what the language would do would be to create two separate appropriations, one for Judicial Department operating funds, one for Indigent Defense funds. And the actual language that creates a division says that such expenses, and they're talking about Indigent Defense expenses, shall be paid only from funds specifically appropriated, therefore, and no other monies appropriated to the Judicial Department or State Court Administrator shall be used for these purposes. And the rationale behind it is simply, if because of caseload increases, crime rate increases, you know, whatever the factor is, there are increases in Indigent Defense costs, the Judicial Department operating funds, the monies we use to keep the courts going, to keep the courtrooms operating, to pay for staff, etc., shouldn't be looked at as the fund to go to pull money out of to offset increased Indigent Defense expenditures. In the indigent defense budget that was passed in Ways and Means, there was budget note language that acknowledged there are certain factors, and they were crime rate, law enforcement and prosecution actions, caseload increases, state and federal appellate decisions, things that will affect costs in this area that are beyond the control of the judicial department and in some sense beyond the control of anyone, and that those kinds of things, they're not going to look to the judicial department to pony up money to cover. This is a clear recognition in law that there's got to be a division. There's funds to operate the courts, and there are funds to pay for indigent defense services.
Okay, any questions on that? How about, let's go to on section 14, which is the orders, and then it expands the requirements for the information coming in. Does anyone have any questions about that? Okay.
Well, I guess I've got a question for Mr. Linden. What happens when you folks have to defend on a mandamus action, in which an individual who may feel aggrieved under that section claims that the decision has been inappropriate in terms of payment? Is it going to be the judge that's brought in on a mandamus and ultimately you folks, or is it going to be a direct action against you folks? Sort of anticipating, unfortunately, the kind of legal actions that I think we have to anticipate with adoption of some of these provisions.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Springer, I think that as custodian of the funds, it would be myself who would actually get mandamus, particularly if the judge is not ordering payment, but is rather certifying what he or she thinks is a reasonable amount. It's difficult to predict. I mean, they might bring in all the parties possible, but I think that if an attorney felt he or she had been underpaid in an individual case, they would probably bring the action against the custodian of the funds.
Mr. Chair, follow-up to that. Bill, do you anticipate that if an attorney or counsel is dissatisfied with whatever the trial judge, quote, certifies, and I don't know, it's the trial judge or the presiding judge in that district that necessarily certifies it, but what appeal, if any, would that individual have? Could they ask that judge to quote, reconsider, or is there some procedure by which they can petition to you to reconsider, and what sort of standards for reconsideration would guide you?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Springer, they would still have available to them an informal process of appeal. What happens right now and what would continue is if an attorney feels the amount the judge orders paid is unreasonable, they can attempt to get the judge to amend that order. And the way they do it typically is they'll sit down and say, here's what I had in this case, and go through it in whatever detail the judge wants. And if the judge felt that the amount was not sufficient to compensate the lawyer, they can change that. It doesn't happen very often. As far as any administrative appeal, the way I would deal with this would be that, you know, we unless there's an arithmetic error, we're not going to change the amount the judge finds to be reasonable. However, the lawyer would have the option of bringing a legal proceeding, which could go to an appellate court on the issue of the adequacy of the fees, or on the issue of whether the actual compensation is less than the statutory $30 an hour.
Can be heard on a related matter. Right. When I took office, I found...
Excuse me, I think you may have to identify yourself.
Oh, Sid Lejack, interim indigent defense administrator. when I took office, I found that there were a number of requests for arbitration on which nothing had been done. I've since received an indication that unless something is done, that there is some thought being given by one attorney in particular to a mandamus action. I think I should inform the committee right now that there are not enough funds in the administrative budget to pay my agreed upon salary, let alone to pay for arbitration proceedings. So I don't want you to be taken by surprise when you hear that a mandamus has been in fact filed to require funds to be spent for arbitration, which are not presently available to the board. One of the little problems I've been dealing with.
your salary's not a problem, then I guess should we take it from the...
No, that's right. No. Of course not.
Thank you, Mr. Lezak.
You're welcome.
Okay. Any questions on that portion? And that Section 22 deals with juvenile aspect of that, and I think that's been explained unless there's any further questions there. And the emergency clause, if we were to take action, this is obviously, I suppose the board would like to know whether it's going to be here or not, plus in addition to the fact that there's some contracts that are, what is it, are these on a fiscal year basis?
Mr. Chairman, yes, they are. The new contracts, or the old contract, the existing contracts expire June 30th of 87.
Was there some action down in action? Did something happen in Curry County? Did that occur today? Or
Mr. Chairman, yesterday the presiding judge in that district held an attorney in contempt who refused to take a case on $30 an hour. There was a contract in that county. However, the number of units to be covered under the contract had been fulfilled, and the court was left with the option of appointing individual attorneys. I don't know. That attorney has a week to decide whether or not he's going to actually take the case before he'd be in actual contempt.
Okay. A couple of options here I guess we could move on. There's the, we just in time, Mr. Phillips.
Okay.
We could take a motion to adopt the -4 amendments. In doing so, that would at least at this subcommittee level, indicate acceptance of the elimination of the Defense Board Administrator. There's a possibility to amend that. Representative Springer?
Well, let me try this, Mr. Chair. I would like to move adoption of the -4 amendments. However, I would like to delete those provisions of the -4 amendments which speak to the abolition of the Indigent Defense Board and its functions.
Okay. Representative Springer would move to amend House Bill 2869 with the -4 amendments, which are LC 875, with the exception of those sections which deal with the elimination of the Indigent Defense Board, which are essentially Section 1 and 2, and then those statements which go therein.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bauman.
I guess the question is for Representative Springer. I'm trying, and it's also a historical question because I don't have the benefit of the history of establishing the State Indigent Defense Board that you referred to. But it seems to me from testimony to the subcommittee that the Indigent Defense Board is advocating its own demise or a poll of members of the board indicated that none of them wish to continue serving on the board.
If I were a member of the board at this point, I'd probably feel the same way. I guess my sense is that I sense, although I haven't been in personal communication in any detail with any of the members of the board, but it's my sense that they probably personally and collectively feel a tremendous sense of frustration in terms of the circumstances in which they were placed, the sort of duties that they were asked to perform, the expectations without any realistic or meaningful opportunity to fulfill those obligations because of the constraints of funding and sort of the more immediate circumstances which they faced. So I respect those individuals, and I certainly respect their feelings. I think they've each worked very, very hard as citizens without any really adequate compensation to perform an impossible task. And I think perhaps that statement that they no longer wish to serve in that mission impossible, I can certainly appreciate. I think our responsibility is to fund the board, to give them the means that they need to perform their job and not to abolish it. That's the reason for my motion. And perhaps we should hear from a member of the board as well, who certainly I would refer to in terms of representing the sentiments of those individuals. Or
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm George Reeves, member of the State Engine Defense Board at the moment. I think it is too strong a term, Representative Bauman, to suggest that the members of the board are advocating the abolition of the board. I don't believe that the abolition of the board had occurred to the members of the board. It was something that apparently came out of some committee in which the board had no participation whatsoever. And we heard about it before the Ways and Means Subcommittee hearing started, as far as the board is concerned. Once the matter was placed in that context, and we perceived that the emphasis that was so strongly on cost, and that there was some